Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we will talk a little bit about how America breaks down in terms of values and how that may be likely to influence people as they decide who they'd like to vote for in the presidential election this year. And in part, we'll be talking about a survey that was done late last year by the Zogby International, a very well-known big public opinion survey research firm. And what they did was they went out and they took a look at attitudes of people in those states that in the election of 2000 either had gone for President Bush or those who had gone for Vice President Gore. In the shorthand, these are called the red states and the blue states, because when you see those maps on television and they show you which state went for which candidate, they color one red and one blue. And they went out there and they surveyed their attitudes on a number of subjects. And interestingly enough, or perhaps you would say not surprising, it looks as if the way that the country was divided up last time in 2000, it hasn't changed, that we still have a very divided country. And we'll be talking a little bit about the survey results with our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580. His name is John Kenneth White. He's a consultant to Zogby International and, in fact, has written an analysis of that values poll. He's professor of politics at the Catholic University of America, and he is also the author of a book titled The Values Divide, American Politics and Culture in Transition. It's published by Chatham House Publishers. And in his analysis, he starts this way, and I think it's a nice way to put it. He notes the fact that the motto of the United States is E Pluribus Unum. That's a Latin phrase, and it translates as out of many, one. He writes, however, that today that motto should be rephrased to read E Pluribus Duo, or out of many, two. He says that that survey, the one that we'll talk about, shows a nation that is deeply divided by party, ideology, the presidency of George W. Bush, and most importantly, by values. In fact, he goes on to state that not since the Civil War and post-Reconstruction has America been as divided as it is today. As we talk with John Kenneth White, of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. We ask only that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different calls as possible. But if you'd like to call in and be a part of the conversation, you are certainly welcome to do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, and then toll-free 800-222-WILO. Professor White, hello.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. And I guess I want to make sure that that you think basically that I've got it right here to start out, at least if we talk about where America seems to be today and draw some comparisons between where America seemed to be in 2000, the last time we had a presidential race. It was very divided then, it's very divided now, and it doesn't seem to have changed very much.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, it's astonishing because many thought that 9/11 changed everything. The vice president talked about the new normal. But what is so remarkable about this president and this administration is that even though we've had life-changing events in some ways, like September the 11th, 2001, the political divisions keep coming back to where they were. And it is absolutely the most remarkable thing. Just a small footnote on this. The Zogby people did their recent national survey this week looking at George W. Bush's job approval rating and re-elect numbers, and they are right back to where they were prior to the capture of Saddam Hussein, which had to be about the shortest bounce in the polls in history.
Well, I'm interested in perhaps doing a very quick look at the poll results, and I guess that on the red side of things, that is, the Republican side, or maybe we don't want to use a party label. We just say these were the states where people supported the president, where those states went for the president. If you look at those people and you look at their attitudes about a number of things, it seems that they are remarkably consistent. They support the president. They support the war on terror. They believe in things like the importance of religion in public life. They are opposed to the idea of same-sex marriage. They are opposed to abortion. That is, you know, if you looked at some of those things that, without meaning to sound too pejorative, you would say are litmus kind of issues of whether you're Republican or Democrat, or whether you're left or right, or liberal or conservative. It seems that these folks in the red states, those that voted for President Bush in 2000, support him and they take the conservative position on all of these issues, particularly the values issues, right down the line.
That's absolutely right. And the way I would describe it is as follows. First, the red state voters are much more likely to be members of the Republican Party than the blue or gore states. As you said, they're much more likely to attend church and be in a church pew, whatever their denomination is, on a Sunday morning. And I think when it comes to values, the way I would describe them is that they believe in absolute truth. In other words, there is a right and a wrong. And even though we know that our country's values have changed significantly in the last 30 or 40 years or so, whether we talk about race relations or more women working than ever before, and even when it comes to gay rights, they accept some of those changes, but they want them to be bounded, if you will, by respect for traditional institutions and traditional values. So these red state voters really do believe that there is a right and a wrong, and there needs to be respect for that, even as they may profess to be tolerant.
There's something else that, to me, it seems very striking when you look at the poll results, when you look at the responses of the people in the red states versus the responses in the people in the blue states. And when you ask particular kinds of questions, they asked about how people felt about the Clintons, and they asked about the legitimacy of the president. They asked about the war on terror. For example, here we'll pick one, and here they were asked about the policy on Iraq, whether or not people favored the idea of, you know, how they felt about the war, whether they thought that was the right policy, and so forth. And if you, for example, you look at the red states, the people that supported the president, the majority of the people there basically say they support the president, although there are some people who disagree. And on all of those sort of bedrock issues, if you look at the Republicans, there is some disagreement, but mostly people seem to support the president and take the kinds of positions on these issues that you would expect. To me, what I think is really interesting is what happens when you look at the blue states. These were the people that before, the states where they went for Al Gore, where presumably here we're talking about Democrats or people who lean Democrats. And there, on the blue side, things are, on many of these issues, things are much more evenly divided. So it seems that not only do we have a divided country, but at least on the blue side, the Democrat side, there's much more diversity of opinion on these issues, as if it seems like the people on that side they're not as sure about what they think and what they believe than are the Republicans.
That's true. A caveat, the poll was taken right after the capture of Hussein, which of course inflated Bush's job approval rating, pushed that up to 53%, which is, again, it's back down now to 49%. And it inflated some of the support for the war in Iraq in the blue states, which I suspect, again, has gone back to the pre-Saddam Hussein levels. But you're absolutely right. And I think what's going on is that, you know, like-minded people like to associate with like-minded people. And one of the things that we found during the Iraq War was as follows. If you got your news and information from Fox News, for example, We found that Fox News viewers supported the Iraq war no matter what. If there were hundreds of American casualties, they were unshakable. If there were thousands of casualties, American or Iraqi, civilian or military, they were unshakable. And no matter what question you posed to them, those Fox News viewers were standing with President Bush no matter what. On the other hand, CBS News viewers, ABC News viewers, ABC particularly, which tends to do better in some of the blue states, they were less supportive. Now, we don't have that kind of pure liberal media test in the surveys from that period where, you know, there would be this very identifiable strong liberal media outlet, the Rush Limbaugh in reverse sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that if we had that, we would have found the same thing. And so what I think is going on is that we have really two very separate countries, each kind of living in parallel universes and each claiming that they are American.
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't mean to belabor this point, but I think, look, for example, at some of the values issues, not so much political, or at least in terms of national security. But if you, for example, one of the questions was asked had to do with the issue of same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked people, they presented them with two statements, statement A and B. And statement A goes like this. Regarding marriage, the question they asked was, regarding marriage, which of the two statements comes closer to your opinion? Either governments recognize a civil union between two persons of the same sex, or governments should only recognize marriage between a man and a woman. The people in the red states, these are the Bush people, 70% of them said that governments should only recognize marriage between a man and a woman. But if you go over there and look on the blue side, on the Gore side, there was a much more even distribution, where there 55% of those people actually said government should only recognize marriage between a man and woman, and 42% agree with that other statement that, you know, government should recognize civil union between two people of the same sex. And it seems like here there's an example, and I don't think it's exactly unusual, on one of these values issues where the Republicans seem to be much more of one mind than the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. And here's how I would analyze that. I think what's going on in the blue states is that voters there like their morality writ small, meaning my morality is for me but not necessarily for you. Yes, I'm happy to tell you my value story, so to speak, what my family life is like, what my sexual preferences are, and so on, but that no one should derive any kind of lesson from that other than me. So they, as I said, they really like their morality writ small, and that therefore applies to gay rights, where the overriding value is really, I think, tolerance. They're still uncomfortable with the idea of marriage as such, less uncomfortable with the idea of civil unions, but very comfortable with the idea that if, say, Vermont or Massachusetts wants to either institute a civil unions law or a gay marriage, that they should be permitted to do that.
One of the sort of abiding bits of conventional wisdom about politics is that people maybe talk about ideology a lot, but when they vote their pocketbooks.
Mm-hmm.
They're interested in the economic impact of politics and how decisions made on the national level affect them. If you perhaps set aside, and I think this poll also tried to do this, if you tried to kind of set aside some of the more ideological issues for a moment and look at those where you can ask this question about how it is that the policy of the administration has affected people in a very direct way, and perhaps in terms of their economic situation is one of the most direct ways you can think of, how that influences what people say and whether or not they support the administration and its policies. If you try to find out, you know, who's doing well and who's not,
sure,
and there, you know, maybe again there you wouldn't really be surprised to find out, if you break things down that way, who it is that thinks who is supportive of the president and who's not.
Well, let me try to answer your question this way. I think that there are two interesting cross currents at work. One is the economy. How am I doing? Am I better off than I was 4 years ago, for example? In a lot of ways, that kind of thinking about the importance of the economy really does date back to the New Deal period, and not surprisingly, that when the country was in a Great Depression and the Democratic New Deal policies of Franklin Roosevelt seemed to be working, it's not surprising that the economy would matter most, and certainly the Democrats captured control of that issue. Though they began to lose that in the 1950s, a little bit under Eisenhower, and more especially in the late 1960s and 1970s as inflation and unemployment by the Carter era of 1980, they had begun to really lose their once dominant position on the economy, and they haven't regained that to the extent of the New Deal period. And yet, but what happened, I think, when if you ask this question about values, we actually don't have polling questions on values until the 1970s and early 1980s, where surprisingly, during the Reagan period, the Democrats actually had a lead on values questions in terms of protecting traditional family values, which is really a New Deal legacy. We have lots of values questions in the 1990s and recently. And one of the separations here has been between the economy on one hand and a values divide between the parties on the other. And my thesis has been that values do indeed matter most, and that if for a party or a candidate to get a hearing on economic questions, the voter first has to believe or feel that a candidate or party shares their values. Now, at the same time, once they can achieve that level, then it's how do you make those values more real in people's lives? Ronald Reagan was the first who really talked about values a lot. In his speeches, he talked about family and work, neighborhood, peace and freedom. But Americans responded not only to that values rhetoric, but to the policies in 1984 when they believed that they were being enhanced by his programs. Bill Clinton understood this values talk. In every Clinton speech, there were the words opportunity, community, and responsibility. It wasn't just saying family values over and over again. It was citing specific values that Clinton wanted to enhance as during his presidency. And so from the acceptance speech to the farewell speech, you get this same recitation of values over and over again. I think what's happened in the case of Bush is that he has been buoyed in the polls for a long time beyond where you would think he would be given the state of the economy, given the job losses in the country. But I think what's buoyed him, particularly in the red states, is that voters there believe that he shares their values and their lifestyle.
And
they identify with him.
It's not really, I guess one of the things that I have, that seems also to be one of those bits of conventional wisdom about politics, is that the two parties, people see them as having different personalities and having different strengths and weaknesses, and that generally speaking, when people feel that the security of the country is at stake, they are more likely to turn to a Republican because they think the Republicans are better at that. But when that's not the issue, when their primary concern is, say, social economic issues, that they are likely to turn to the Democrats because they think that the Democrats are better at that. And that would suggest that perhaps maybe the reason that there is the high level for the president is the continuing concerns about terrorism, and that people do feel that the security of the country is at stake. And when it's, you know, when things are like that, you need a Republican. That's what people seem to think.
Yeah, there's some of that. Chris Matthews has this wonderful analogy where he calls the Republicans the daddy party, the party that's going to protect us, while Democrats are the mommy party, a party that's going to provide care and comfort on the social justice and economic questions that you described. I think there's something to that, but I also believe very strongly that when we ask these polling questions in terms of does George W. Bush share your values, and as you know, in this recent survey, we actually had a question about the Clintons, and we found a big difference between the red and blue states on the question, because the blue states were more likely to think that they shared the values as embodied by Bill and Hillary Clinton, and red states were decidedly turned off by that. I think, again, the share your values questions is really important. I think it's buoyed Bush. It certainly buoyed him in 2002, not just terrorism. I agree with what you're saying, but I think there's also this other dimension to it that's very important.
Well, let me introduce again our guest. We have a caller, and we'll get right to and would welcome others. We're talking with John Kenneth White. He's professor of politics at the Catholic University of America. He's also a consultant to Zogby International, a big polling firm. And he did a commentary and analysis of the results of this poll that we have been talking about that was done by Zogby in December, looking at the attitudes of people in those states that either had supported President Bush or Vice President Gore in the presidential race in 2000. Professor White argues that the country was very divided then. It continues to be very divided now, particularly on values issues, and that things perhaps haven't changed very much over the last 4 years. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Chicago to talk with on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if your polling is not really looking at values, but really at social opinions. And I have two reasons for saying this. You think values are deeply held and rational, well thought out or thought over through tradition or religious beliefs, and if something was a value, the capture of Saddam Hussein should not have affected anyone's values. The second point is brings to mind yesterday when Mr. Bush made a phone call saying that he held all life sacred, and people accepted this, even though we know as governor he oversaw several executions, many of which were questionable, and the policy of preemptive war, which has killed at least 5,000 innocent Afghanis. I mean, there's somewhere, there's some problem with calling these things value if people do not question a statement like that, whereas I could accept if that was your social opinion, because socially it is acceptable to fear people who threaten your society. I don't know, I just find it very hard to accept that these are values, because there doesn't seem to be anything deeply thought out in any of this. I can accept all of this as opinions, along with the attitude of go along to get along.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me respond to you this way. First of all, the capture of Saddam Hussein isn't a values issue. It certainly is an event, and people are going to respond to that event. But when we look at opinion, there are really two components. One is beliefs. That is, the facts as people accept them or know them about the world that they're observing. And the second is values. Abortion is both a social issue, as you suggest, but it also has a values component, where on one side it's the respect for life and the valuing of life, and for the other side it's the idea of freedom of choice. What makes this country, I think, really unique is that each of the red states and blue states, but all of us, are asked to answer the question, what does it mean to be an American? And when we answer that question, we often answer that in terms of values, that is, the right to be free or to exercise our freedoms, a belief in equality of opportunity, a heightened role for the individual and to judge me as a person and not on the basis of class or race or anything else. And that's always a profound question for Americans to answer. The Cold War gave us some easy answers to that, because we could say we're not communists. And in fact, the red the talk of a red-blue state divide during the Cold War period is something of an anomaly, because then all politics did stop at the water's edge. With the end of the Cold War, values, I think, have emerged as an important phenomena, because they really go to very different answers to this notion of what it means to be an American. And it involves different answers to basic values that I've just described, like freedom, like equality of opportunity, like individualism. Gay rights is a good example of that, because each side takes those same basic values but interprets them quite differently.
So I don't see where you're testing this idea of value. It seems to me that in any examination, you would question the person further. If the person said that they respected all life, there should be two questions in there. One, do you support, are you pro-choice or pro-life? Are you against capital punishment or for capital punishment? Are you against war or for war? I mean, to sort of try to get some sort of qualitative examination of this question of value, because just saying that you hold all life sacred and then think that capital punishment is all right and war is fine, it seems to me that you're not, that measurement of saying this person holds this as a value will not have any predictive power, because if you're thinking that that person holds life sacred and therefore they will not vote a certain way, you're going to be wrong.
Well,
do you see what I'm saying?
I understand exactly what you're saying. And in the survey, of course, we did ask about abortion. We asked about the death penalty. But what I think comes up over and over and over again are these values or lifestyle questions regarding church attendance or marriage or having children at home, the degree of commitment to faith. And when we ask those kinds of questions, as well as the ones that you just indicated, we get the same kind of divisions that are happening over and over and over again, and indeed they're deepening. I would just add that the marriage gap that we've seen in 2003 is tremendous, and we also see more married people, by the way, in the red states than in the blue states. These religious differences by church attendance are huge, and so we live in a country with significantly different lifestyles, if you will, in these red and blue states, and we're finding, again, these differences that are extending into the 2004 presidential election. People will take issues like abortion and the death penalty, where life is a value in one, but in the death penalty is overridden, if you will, by people, I think, in the red states, with a sense of justice on the other. So they'll always hold competing values, if you will, in hand. And our job, and we're trying to do this, is to measure these things. And it's not just the Zogby poll, but we have a variety of polls that really look at these types of questions.
I just want to make one last comment, because I think what I'm trying to say is that it's not the measurement across the groups. It's the confusion within each individual that I think is missing in polling this way. You're not catching the contradictions within one person's value system when we get the results of the red and blue states, because I assume you're grouping the response by question, whereas if there's this confusion within the individual's response and within their final tally sheet, again, I feel that this has really no predictive power, because you're really looking at is bits and pieces of all these opinions rather than the fact that all of these individuals are very conflicted about their values, might be affected by a sudden event such as the capture of Saddam Hussein.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, as I said earlier on that last point, sure, we'll have events that that change the landscape, but what's so remarkable is how quickly the landscape reverts back to that same basic red-blue divide. When you look at polls as much as I do, one of the things you discover is that there's a structure to public opinion, and that the public is not as fickle, if you will, as you might think. Sure, they're moving about now on the Democratic side between Dean and Kerry and Edwards and all the rest, and their opinions are rather softly held and can easily change as events of the recent week's show with the Dean campaign. But when you look at these values questions, I am really so struck by the fact that there's an enormous stability to public opinion, and that it's not as soft as you might suggest, because there are these conflicting values.
I need to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me, because we're already past our midpoint, and I have some other callers I want to get to, particularly someone here who is on a cell phone. So let's go there to line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question for you in a similar vein as the last individuals, but I was curious if you've had any, for lack of a better term, demographics on whether the pulpit influence has any effect. Is there any effect, say, in the South, I presume it's a higher percentage of Baptists, and maybe in the North it's maybe Presbyterian or Catholic, and in other areas possibly Muslim or Jewish. Has that shown any significance in it, or is it pretty much across the board? And I'll hang up.
Sure. Well, we did see within the red-blue state divide a higher content. Hello.
Yeah, our line should have hung up, and it didn't. So,
okay, let me try again.
Yeah,
we saw within the red blue state divide a higher concentration of Protestants within those red states, and a higher concentration of born agains within those red states. Again, I think what's going on is a kind of interesting cultural federalism. So if you're born again, and you're Protestant, you like living in Alabama or Mississippi or Texas. You like to associate with like-minded people. We did see a higher percentage of Catholics within the blue states. And as far as the Muslims, the sample was just not great enough so that we could make that kind of determination as such. With respect to, I think he asked about the Pope or the influence of the Pope, what I would say really on this is that in the red states, there's more attention to the importance of institution as a locator for finding and understanding and an expression of religious belief and faith. And in the blue states, those expressions are much more personal. That is, I can pray to God at any time. Certainly both red and blue believe in the existence of God and the power of prayer, but where and how they find and use those beliefs are, and the expressions of which are quite different.
Just real quick to come back to another point, and then I'll get on to the next caller. I promise that person I won't make him wait forever. Just recently I heard some political commentator make the observation that one of the things that's true about American politics today is that there simply aren't very many people who are undecided in terms of whether they would be red or blue, at least in that sense. That, you know, you can't, someone who could truly say, well, gosh, I don't know, I guess I could vote Republican, or I guess I could vote Democrat. There just almost isn't anybody like that anymore.
I agree with that analysis, and to add to it, whoever the Democratic nominee is, in all likelihood, is going to wind up with 45% of the vote simply for the fact that he now is likely to be nominated. There may be some exceptions to that, Kucinich, Sharpton, and possibly Dean. But it's like the SAT test. You get 200 points for putting your name on the exam, as John Zogby likes to say, and I think he's absolutely right on that. As a result, therefore, the strategies may be somewhat different this time, which is to turn out partisans.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know that if you can identify Republicans or Democrats, you're likely to get their support. And what makes 2004 different, say, from the Nixon or Reagan elections in the 1980s, is that there are no Bush, George W. Bush Democrats. They're simply not there. And there are no, or very few, Republican defectors from George W. Bush to either a generic Democrat or whoever the nominee may be.
Hmm.
And that's pretty extraordinary.
Let's take another caller. This is someone listening in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if John could comment on something David Brooks was talking about in his book, Bobos in Paradise. He was talking about the green Puritans, kind of people on the progressive side of politics who were kind of had absolutist morality of kind of in different areas, like in banning smoking, banning SUVs, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that the book is a wonderful book, and I was informed by it greatly. Yeah, I think there is, obviously, when it comes to that sort of green Puritan, I like that phrase, by the way, this again, kind of, there is a kind of rigidity there. But when you really deal with, I think, the new professionals more broadly, and you look at the types of people that have been gravitating to the Dean campaign, the Democrats, they still like their morality writ small. They do believe in the environment. That's a high priority, an important issue to them. It can lead to this kind of moral absolutism about banning smoking and doing other forms of behavior. But still, again, generally, they have all kinds of stories that they can tell, but they still want, when it comes to moral questions and issues, they really still like their morality writ small.
Let's go to Belgium, over by Danville, and that would be line number 4. Hello.
Hello. In these surveys you do, or other people do, has anybody asked about a person's perception of this president? Or other presidents, you know, you take a look at Lincoln, and you have a perception of a very magnanimous person who did right for everybody. Mm-hmm. You look at other ones, and they seem to be intellectuals like Wilson. When this gentleman presents himself, he doesn't really present himself in a very intellectual way. Are those questions ever asked about this?
Well, we have asked questions about to the public as to how they would rank the presidents in terms of their greatness, but I think that your suggestion is really a good one, which is to ask this and to look more carefully at the red and blue states. We know that the public has ranked Washington, Lincoln, Franklin D. Roosevelt very highly. They've ranked John Kennedy fairly highly. In 2000, one of the interesting things was how the presidency of George Bush Sr. had risen in the public's estimation, which was a sign of things to come. So I think that's a very good point, and the next time that we do this survey, I would suggest that we take a look at that and see whether we find these kind of unifying figures between the red and blue states in the case of Lincoln or Washington, which I suspect, or John Kennedy, and which presidents are more divisive than one would expect, certainly Bill Clinton and the presidency of George W. Bush to fall in those categories, but perhaps others as well. It's an interesting question.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right,
you're
thanks.
Welcome.
We have about 15 minutes left, and I would like to introduce again our guest for this hour. We're speaking with John Kenneth White. He's professor of politics at the Catholic University of America, which is in Washington, D.C. He also serves as a consultant to Zogby International, which is a big public polling firm, a public opinion polling and research firm. And we've been talking a little bit about a survey that was done in December, looking at the attitudes of people in those states that in 2000 went for Bush and those states that in 2000 went for Gore, and asking them a variety of questions about their attitudes on things. And in an analysis of the results, as I mentioned at the beginning, his observation, that is our guest's, John White's observation, is that it is a nation, the United States, deeply divided by party, by ideology, by the presidency of George Bush, but most important, he says, it's divided by values. And if you're interested in this whole question, you might also look for a book that he's authored that's titled The Values Divide, American Politics and Culture in Transition. It's published by Chatham House. That's the publisher. I would just for a second here, I'm interested in asking this question. You know, now I think when people, politicians or others, use the word values, and they talk about the importance of values, you don't have to ask them what they mean, what kind of values they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think everybody seems to know what that means. And I guess I'm interested in how it is that values, lowercase, became values, capital V-A-L-U-E-S,
right.
so that now you can use that term and everybody knows what values mm-hmm. that you're talking about.
Right.
And in fact, people might, even though the people are going to disagree on what those things, how they feel about the particular issues, that is, you know, everybody knows what values means. How did that happen?
Well, I would argue that we really began to see that with Ronald Reagan, that one of the things that Reagan did in terms of transformed our politics around a certain set of policies. As we all know, the government is not the solution, but rather the problem, and so on, and Reaganomics and all the rest. But Reagan constantly talked the language of values, and in so many ways transformed the presidency. If you think back to Reagan's State of the Union addresses, they weren't so much legislative policy prescriptions. He was less a prime minister and more of a minister, if you will, that is, telling different people's stories, you know, pointing to the people in the gallery and telling their stories from which the listener could derive a kind of moral lesson. Bill, as I said before, Bill Clinton understood that quite well, and so did some of the Democratic candidates. We see Mr. Lieberman constantly talking about values, but also his expression of religious faith as part of his story. We see Mr. Kerry talking about his Vietnam War service so that he too can embody the value of patriotism and heroism and service and all the rest. John Edwards talks about being the son of a mill worker. And what these candidates need to do, and I think they are doing it to varying degrees of success, is to try to make that kind of values connection with the audience. This is, by the way, it's in stark contrast to Howard Dean, at least at the outset. It says, you know, I'm not going to talk about my values. My values are my values, and your values are yours. These are the facts, and this is why I want to be president. Later, there was this very clumsy values connection, going to church with Jimmy Carter, talking about the importance of religion, etc. But I think the more successful candidates have been very consistent in terms of trying to make those connections and understand that they need to make those connections in order to get hearings on other issues that matter most to them.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with them. The next is in Danville, line number one. Hello.
Yes. When you do your reassessment, I hope you include the responses that you've received this morning. It shows how flawed those different assessments can be, considering the time and that. I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Well, I think that the callers have had some good questions that we can add to the survey. But one of the things when we've done this and other surveys, and not just Zogby International, but various other polling organizations, again, what we see are these same lifestyle differences that occur over and over and over again. And I think the divisions within the country are in fact hardening. And I see no evidence really that 2004 is going to produce a result terribly different, though those small differences will be crucial this year, but not all that terribly different than where we were in 2000. The country is rapidly changing. It's changing demographically. It certainly has undergone a significant values shift on a variety of different issues and questions, to be sure. And some parts of the country are very comfortable with those changes, and others are not.
Well, one of the things certainly we know about politics is it's very dangerous to make predictions about the future because things can change very quickly, and no one knows what the future holds. Having said that, though, I'm interested in following up on your last comment. And when you're talking about this year's presidential contest, whether you're saying that, whether you're simply saying that, like 2000, that it's going to be very close, or are you saying that if you were a betting man, that your money would be on President Bush being reelected?
Well, two ways. First, I think it is going to be close. And I think most careful observers really do believe fundamentally that this is going to be a close election. It is extraordinarily unlikely that we would have a landslide of a Goldwater or McGovern dimension for either party. I don't think that's going to happen. And one reason for that is the hardening of those divisions between the red and blue states. That said, there are several states that are in play, but not all that many. And I think that the election is going to come down to a handful of states. I don't think we're going to know the result at 10 o'clock, either Eastern or your time, on election night. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a very, very long night.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
So are the blue states, do they have the most potential for population growth?
Right. I wish I could give you a direct answer. Here are the two answers. For the red states, it is the fact that their electoral vote has grown by 7 or 8 votes since 2000. That is, if you take the states that George W. Bush won and got to 271 electoral votes. I think the additional number of electoral votes they have this time as a result of redistricting and the 2000 census and so on, all of that taking effect, is 7 votes greater. But when you look at other elements of this, if you look at the growth of new-collar professionals, you look at the growth of Hispanic voters. By 2050, whites will be a minority in the entire United States. And one of the things that fascinates me is that 30 years ago, there was a book titled The Real Majority, in which the thesis was, the real majority was un-young, un-poor, and un-black, or to put it another way, white, middle-aged, middle-income. George W. Bush carried those groups in 2000 overwhelmingly and lost the popular vote. He is winning the same groups overwhelmingly in whatever tests we do with either hypothetical Democratic candidates or an unnamed Democratic candidate. And yet, as the question suggests, that old real majority is now the real minority.
Yeah, and that's going to be a continuing problem because it's a nut that society is not likely to be able to digest. I was kind of all this made me think of a article I read a couple of years ago in the Daily Telegraph. It mentioned Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, where it states that Tories and liberals are born and not made, and it mentioned that in conjunction with a study done out of the University of Western Ontario, where they found that conservative values are much more genetically, based, or there are more genetic ties to conservative values than there are to liberal values, and it really seems kind of like a bleak future. I'll hang up and let somebody else on.
Yeah, I don't. I've never heard that, and I'd have to really think about that. I don't think that there's a genetic component to this so much, as again, it really revolves around lifestyle, like-minded associations, and the lack of a common memory, if you will. You know, one of the unique periods in American history is really the 1950s, when we talked about the organization man, the sense of sameness, and all the rest. And what we have now with these two very different countries almost is either experiences like 9/11 that to some are interpreted in very different ways, or again, two very separate kinds of culture, whether it's one's radio station you listen to, or the television programs you watch, or where you get your news from.
We'll try to get at least one more caller. Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Line 3? Yes. I'm wondering about populism as something that might unify us. And one of the issues that I've been surprised not to see more of is talk about inequality in wealth and income, because it seems as though, you know, even if people are looking at themselves and saying, well, I'm doing all right, most people can say, I'm not doing very well, you know, in prospect.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you there, caller, but we're really short on time. We have to see if we can get a quick response here from the guest.
That certainly has been the Democratic argument, particularly in the states of the old Confederacy, including the South. I don't think that argument flies because, again, you need to make that values connection. What this survey showed is a couple of inroads for Democrats in red states around the question of trade, where they're very skeptical about free trade and connect that to job loss, and also Medicare reform, where, again, red state voters are very skeptical and not terribly supportive of what the president has done in that area.
We're going to have to leave it at that. I have some other folks here we can't take. My apologies, but I'm sure we'll get back to some of these issues again. For the moment, we want to say thanks to our guest, John Kenneth White. He's professor of politics at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. His book is The Values Divide, American Politics and Culture in Transition. If you'd like to read it, published by Chatham House Publishers. And Professor White, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.